Okay, so we've been practicing a lot with coming into the body. You might have noticed, hopefully you've noticed, that we've been practicing a lot with coming into the body. And we haven't focused too much particularly on breath, but there's been a lot of body grounding techniques, which is some of the aspect of form of our experience. And then this morning also starting to touch on some of the mental stuff that can be going on, which is another conditioned aspect of our experience. It's another aspect of form that we experience and how we get formed up, actually, by our habits and by our thoughts. So our life takes on a certain shape through our thinking processes, through our feelings, and through how we respond to them. And in meditation, some of what we're hoping to do is find tools to see those things clearly, see how we get shaped up, and hopefully, I want to take my jacket off, not be pushed around so much by habits, because we can suffer a lot when we're just caught in a tendency of some tendency of greed or some tendency of aversion. And we come out of, if you like, it's almost like I have an image of like we actually have a kind of well-being internally. We have a sense of well-being. And what happens with our habits is we often get carried away from that. So meditation, some of what we're learning to do is to notice our habits. And in order to do that, we have to have some other resources. So this is why we've been emphasizing a lot coming into the aspect of body that maybe we don't notice so much. So the aspect of body that is we can explore. So it's not our idea of what the body is, but what does it feel like to be inside? What does it feel like to notice our weight? What effect does that have on our mind? Or to contemplate the elements, which is a much more universal aspect of body than our personal, this is me, this is mine. So it can help to open out those things. And then there's another aspect of our experience, which I want to talk a little bit about today, which is also very often there, but unnoticed. And this is the awareness that we have. So like we talk about about giving attention, about becoming present, about bringing awareness. And one of my teachers, Ajahn Sumedho, this was his thing, it was his topic, notice awareness. I mean, it wasn't his topic, but it was his big theme. He really liked teaching about that. So he would say, and I feel really grateful for this, teaches pretty much the same thing, like all the time, like notice awareness, trust in awareness, notice that you're aware. And over years, it slowly seeps in that like whatever experience we're having, so that may be an experience of body, it may be an experience like now, you're hearing my voice. What is aware of my voice? There's a consciousness that is aware. And do we notice that? So like right now, what is aware of my voice? What is aware of your sitting bones on the cushion? And how many times do you notice that in your experience? And this is a really, really powerful tool, because when we have stronger things happening, so fear or aversion or wanting something very strongly and feeling like really, really caught in it, what he would remind in his teaching was, as soon as you know that's what's happening, there is this awareness, there is this presence that is still, actually, that is receiving what is happening. And that's all it's doing. It's only receiving. It's not judging. It's not fighting. It's not grabbing. It's just receiving. So for myself, I've been really, really grateful for this in my practice, because I kind of came to practice very motivated, very much wanting to practice, but with an awful, awful lot of fear, which meant that I was kind of constantly semi-running from my experience. I was like, well, I kind of want to see you, but I didn't feel I had the resources to do that. And then suddenly he was teaching, well, you know, as soon as you know something is happening, as soon as you feel a fear in your body, there is awareness with that. And so, like, and that the awareness is large enough to meet whatever is happening. So, so slowly, slowly, I started to practice with that and really, to start to trust it, which, I feel really grateful for having received that teaching. And the simile is sometimes it's like, the awareness is like the ocean, and what is happening in the mind is like the waves. And so, like, the ocean isn't actually washed away by the waves. The waves can totally be there. It's all right. But the thing that happens often when we get overwhelmed by something is we believe we're only that particular thing. We have no resource to come out and create a bigger picture. So some of that bigger picture is this noticing awareness. So as soon as you feel a particular thing happening, you can also turn the attention around. What is the knowing? What's that knowing like? This is a really, really interesting thing to start to explore. And there is, so it's within the Theravadin teaching, this is sometimes a little bit controversial, because people say, well, is it permanent? Is it not permanent? And who knows? There is a teaching in the suttas, in the supposedly what's been passed down from the Buddha, which says there is an unborn, uncreated, unconditioned, without which there would be no escape from the born, the created, the conditioned. And so Ajahn Sumedho, again, he often would quote that, but it's like, however it is, we can each observe there is this knowing within us. We don't have to make it a permanent state. We don't have to kind of proliferate around what is it, what isn't it. It's like we can observe there is a knowing, and we can experiment. How does that help in our practice? To start to be with what's going on in a present, caring, and unshaken way. So there's a lovely verse in one of the Buddha's teachings that says, it's a little bit splitting language, but it says, although involved in worldly ways, so we're doing our daily things, we're getting on with our life, whatever, unshaken, the mind remains. And so, like, resting in this bigger awareness can really bring that quality of unshakability, not untouchedness, so it's not a coldness, but it's big enough to receive what's happening. So this is something to experiment with. And and still I would say that this is a great tool. It's really, really good to experiment with it. And there's a bit of a danger, I think, with it as well, which is that it needs some other tools to go along with it in order to, for us not to be able to make it into what we want. So, like, we so much have a tendency in spiritual practice to want to get away. I think a lot of us have a tendency to want to get away from suffering. So we're looking for a release from suffering, and actually we want to just, like, if we can, like, just get away, just get the side route. quick out of it. like consciously or unconsciously, we'd really rather it was easier. And so, like what we can do with this, when we notice awareness, what we can do sometimes is make it into a position. Like, okay, now I found this safe place. And we kind of make ourselves into that, which creates a separation from all the messiness of human life. And that's really not a good thing to happen, because with that splitting, I mean, there's all sorts of terms for it. Like, there's a guy called John Wellwood who's written a book called Spiritual Bypassing, which is really worth a read. And it's partly about that tendency to just want to get around whatever's going on. And we can do that very effectively if we go, okay, well, I'm trusting in awareness. I'm sitting in this witness position. I'm just watching what's going on. It doesn't touch me. I'm unaffected. And then eventually what happens is after a few years is generally you have a nervous breakdown because there's just so much stuff accumulated, kind of, that you've gone, no, not me, not mine, nothing to do with me. Yeah, it's like crash. All right. It's quite common in monastic life for people to have nervous breakdowns. And then you learn, you're like, okay, well, I quite clearly can't push all my stuff to one side. I have to actually engage with it. But it's good if you can learn from a bit earlier on before you've, I mean, maybe a nervous breakdown is necessary, but, and one of the ways I found of really helping to engage an awakeness with how we are sitting in awareness is to engage with the teachings that we've been doing in the chants. So like the Metta Sagatina chant, that's teaching about these four qualities of the Brahma-Viharas, which are heart qualities that we can cultivate, and which I think they really help to safeguard our practice in terms of how we're using awareness, how we're approaching our experience. So Noon in a very nice way, she pointed out earlier how in the forest tradition there's this sense of like welcoming the hindrances. What can I learn from you? And in order to do that, we have to have a good basis. We have to have a stability of attention, which can come through grounding in the body. It can come through some concentration practices. We have to have the capacity to stay aware, which noticing awareness can really help us to tune into that, to being able to stay aware, to stay being the one who's receiving what is happening. But also, in order to be willing to engage, our heart has to be somewhat developed. So we can't be approaching our experience with a kind of clinical, all right then, you know, like, okay, well, I'll just prod you with a metal stick, you know, from a distance and see what's going on. We have to be willing. How do you feel heard? Do you feel heard if somebody sits like 50 meters away and like looks at you? What are you anyway, you know? Would that help you to open up? So it's like learning to, with developing heart qualities, we can learn to trust to approach what is happening in a way that it's actually like, oh, hello, what are you? How are you? How can I help you to be heard and to release the suffering that is in this experience, if there is suffering in it? And so, the four heart qualities, many of you will know them already. They're metta, or loving kindness, and karuna, or compassion, mudita, which is sympathetic joy or gladness in another's happiness or well-being, and upekkha, which is equanimity. And so for me, like, just, for instance, directly in terms of noticing how I'm bringing awareness to a particular situation. Metta, or loving kindness, is a quality which helps to see, is my heart open, actually? Am I genuinely receiving what is going on? So is the awareness that I feel is here, is it really open? Is it really clear? Is it really receiving? So the quality of metta is a good sounding board for how is my awareness in that way? Is it open? Is it receiving? And karuna, or compassion, is a really good sounding board for is my interest really to release suffering? Because there may be a way in which I just want to push it away, or I want to grab hold of it. So do I really want to release it? So tuning into the quality of compassion can be a reminder for ourselves, how am I listening? What's my intention with this in that way? And mudita, in terms of cultivating awareness, I was thinking, how does mudita help me? And it helps me by letting me be open to other people's wisdom, actually. So like, the opposite of mudita is when I feel threatened. I don't feel gladness in the connection with others, I feel threatened by it. So when I'm cultivating awareness and I bring in the quality of mudita, I'm able to listen to other beings, listen to other people's wisdom, or see the wisdom of a tree to remind me how to be with something. So it's like the heart qualities come in and help me to check, actually, is my awareness clear? Is it clear in this way when I'm bringing it to my whatever's going on in me? And equanimity is when I, yeah, it's like a measure of, can I see the big picture of what's going on? So equanimity helps really bring a steadiness to experience. And it's like, so does the awareness that's coming internally, does it have this quality of being able to stay steady with, stay present with whatever the ups and downs are of experience? And if it doesn't, how does it need adjusting? Does it need a little bit more metta? Or does it need a little bit more clarity, actually, a bit more compassion to say, okay, I really want to see where the suffering arises here. So we can, it's like we've just got these tools that we can balance, and we can gauge in ourselves when we're present with something, is there that sense of balance? And if there isn't, what may be needed? We've got this whole little toolbox of things. And it's not a theoretical toolbox. It's not like, oh yeah, we're supposed to be quoting, what's the third quality again? You know, it's like, I mean, of course the lists are useful. They are useful, but they're maps for very real qualities that we can cultivate in our hearts. So, so maybe I can say a little bit more about about the four qualities as well, just so that we can recognize them a little bit more clearly. So metta, as I said, is the quality of loving kindness, or friendliness. So often in translations from the Pali, there's a bit of a, it's not always so clear, because one word can mean like 40 different things depending on the context. And but metta is this basic quality of receiving and friendliness, which hopefully one's awareness is doing that anyway. But things to be careful of. So in there's a later teaching, it's not from the original suttas, but there's a later teaching about the so-called near and far enemies of loving, of the four qualities. And the near enemy of loving kindness is clinging attachment. So this would be like, oh, I'm being kind to you because I want something from you. It's like, oh, you're so good at doing that, you know, whereas it's actually like, you're so good at doing that, so please can you do something nice for me? Or please can you affirm me? And that's not loving kindness. Similarly, if we're approaching an inner state and we're going, I'll receive you, I'll be nice to you, as long as within 5 minutes you go away, it's not really it. It's like, no, it's like real, no, I really want to receive you, you know, even if you're here for 3 hours kind of thing. So that's something to be careful of, because we're very slippery, actually. We know what it's like when our heart's really open. And when it's not really, we do get a little bit of a sense of like, oh, I'm just like being a little bit devious here. I'll be nice to you, go away. Right. Okay, next. and the opposite of loving kindness is obviously hatred, or like really obviously pushing something away. And if you find yourself doing that, it can be really helpful to just receive that. Maybe that needs receiving. This experience of like, I really can't deal with you. I really don't want this. Maybe that in itself needs receiving. There's again a really nice teaching from Ajahn Sumedho, which really reminded me, because when we're having difficult things happening, it can be confusing. We're like, is this supposed to be what it's like? Is this, you know, isn't this too messy? Is it not, you know, surely not this kind of thing? And and yet it's almost like if we can trust our hearts to be large enough to receive what's happening and to bring a kindness, it can really be the right moment for something to be happening. So like if there is an experience of strong aversion or hatred or fear, maybe this is the right moment. If we can bring enough awareness, if we can bring enough grounding, if we can bring enough kindness to actually hold that experience, and this is where we can start to meet whatever's happening as a friend. So I remember once I was having a really, really difficult time. Really difficult time. And I'd spoken to lots of my spiritual friends and guides and all of that. And I was convinced that it was all going wrong and that I was going to go mad. And it was totally better that I just, like, leave now. And it was just before I was due to ordain as a nun. And so I was like, oh God, I'm just wrecking everything. This is like the worst possible thing, the worst possible time, etc., etc. And so eventually I went to see Ajahn Sumedho and I explained to him in great detail what was going on. And he just listened. And then I said, and it's the worst possible time. It's like I'm ordaining in 3 weeks or something. And he was like, seems like perfect timing to me, you know. And it sounds kind of really cliched, but it was so helpful, because it was just like what I was doing was just adding and adding and adding to the suffering that was going on by not accepting. And what he reminded me was, I can actually receive this. I can take this in, but I need to bring a quality of acceptance and of kindness and of friendliness. And related to that, of compassion, of being willing to go, and the suffering is in the way I'm adding to it and the way that I'm going, this is wrong, etc. So the compassion is to go, so this bit I cut, actually. I don't need to stay with that. So do you see the difference? Yeah. I mean, you've probably heard the teaching of the first arrow of suffering being what is inevitable in human life, what comes from having a body, having a heart, having a body. There's a certain level of suffering that comes in terms of pain, old age, loss. These are things that are inevitable in our human existence. And the second arrow is what we do with that. The second arrow of suffering is all of the wanting and not wanting and pushing away that we add on, or the holding on to. And so compassion is also like, compassion is what helps us to feel suffering and to know how to release it. And sometimes that is, whereas metta or friendliness, sometimes that's needed to receive. Compassion can be quite fiery and fearsome and go, no, you know, this bit is not needed. This bit is just a circle of suffering that I'm adding on. So if you're having a basic experience of, like, aversion, like towards yourself, for instance, it can be really helpful to come in and to receive that with an attitude of friendliness. To actually go, okay, I want to feel you, to hear you, to see you. The second arrow of suffering, which may need a little bit more clear handling, is to go, actually, I do not believe these thoughts, which are going, this is who I am, this is bad, this shouldn't be here. Everybody else is meditating, surely much better than I am. You know, all of that, that's like just the mind whirring on, because it doesn't want to settle with the pain. It doesn't want to feel the pain. And so there's a certain discernment, this word I used this morning, which I don't know what it is in Finnish, that is able to find out where things are at. And some of our experience, we need to go, okay, well, you know, you can be here, but I'm not going to give you much more attention. And there's some parts of our experience that we need to actually feel into and really hear. So compassion is the part that resonates with suffering in ourselves or with others, and that can see a pretty clear path to what needs to, how to release that. So there's a nice story that I really, really like, which I think really demonstrates these two qualities very nicely, where I saw it on YouTube. Somebody told me about it on YouTube. It's you've probably heard it before, Noon. It's this Afro-American preacher in America, in the south of America, where there's a lot of racism. And there's the Ku Klux Klan. Have you heard of these guys? Yeah. Anyway, so they still exist in the south of America, probably elsewhere as well. And they were really persecuting this preacher. So they were setting fire to things in his garden. They were harassing him with phone calls. They were harassing his family. He had two daughters. And this had gone on for years and years and years. And he'd just decided, I'm not going to respond to them in the same way as they're treating me. So I'm not going to respond with hatred towards them. And so he would receive these phone calls, and he'd pick up the phone and he'd be like, oh, hi, it's you again. You know, like kind of bemuse them, you know, a little bit. But they kept doing it, and it was serious. They were saying, you know, they put a cross in his garden and set fire to it. It's really nasty, nasty, nasty stuff. And then, so one day he goes to a restaurant, a diner, and he's there with his family. So it's quite a vulnerable situation. And then the Ku Klux Klan comes in, and they kind of start threatening him, and they intimidate him, and he's, like, first of all trying to ignore them, and then the leader of the Ku Klux Klan comes forward, and they're eating a chicken, and he says, whatever you do to that chicken, I'm going to do to you. So, like, thinking he would put the knife in or eat it or whatever. So the preacher gets the chicken, and he picks it up, and he kisses it. and then all of the Ku Klux Klan start laughing at their leader, because the leader stepped forward like, I'm the big guy, I'm going to be intimidating, whatever. And this Ku Klux Klan leader actually leaves the Ku Klux Klan. And so this thing I saw on YouTube is his testimonial of, so I was in the Ku Klux Klan and I did all these terrible things. I was like being really horrible, nasty, threatening to this guy and his family. And his relentless kindness kind of wore me down. It just, couldn't do it anymore, you know? And for me, you know, there's something about both metta and compassion in that, because the preacher presumably had a hope that this would release the guy from, you know, his harmful patternings, otherwise he would have just have fought back. Yeah. And I think it's really interesting that he didn't fight back, and sometimes that's what we need to do with our inner state. Sometimes we need to be very sharp and say, no, this is not okay, you know, and sometimes just the power of receiving is enough to take out the power of them to push us around. So like Gandhi in India didn't fight the British, because the British would have known what to do with that. We would have fought back, kind of thing. I'm not proud of that part of being British at all. I'm not proud of being British at all, actually. But whereas when he didn't fight, the British government didn't know what to do with him. So there's something very powerful about this quality of that, being able to receive. And there is also the need for a wisdom and a discernment to go, sometimes this bit I receive, this bit is the addition, this is the second arrow. And then, as I said, mudita can be very supportive in our practice, particularly because it wears away the sense of self-interest. So if we can be glad in another being's well-being, the opposite of that is that we're threatened. And how many times in practice do we sit here and think, God, everybody's practicing so much better than I am. I'm just like the worst, or I shouldn't be here, or I'm better than. So all of that is ourself getting going and trying to make a position in our practice. And so mudita, which feels the gladness in the well-being of others, is a very, very powerful way of undercutting that. Because gladness, it's like, how delightful to be glad that another person is doing well. How nourishing that is for the heart. So it's a really nice thing to just try out. So maybe we should get some chocolate cake and, like, there can be two pieces. We can all be glad for the two people, you know, so it's something like that, you know. But, you know, it's good to experiment with a daily life situation for, you know, something where normally you would feel a little bit like, oh, ouch, you know, that hurts my sense of self. You know, what that person said, or that they got the bit of chocolate cake, or, you know, how we measure each other. Maybe we can find some way of experimenting that, where we see, oh, could I be glad that this person's had a great meditation, or whatever, whereas I've been seeing them going, ouch, ooh, or something. Find something in your life to experiment that with. And then equanimity is this is, like, said to be actually a fruit of developing some of these other qualities. So it's something that's difficult to cultivate directly. But through cultivating a heart of awareness that has these other qualities kind of woven through it, kneaded through it. So the Buddha talks about a heart that is malleable, which means it's like soft and kind of, don't know the word for it. Have you got a word for that? Like you can knead it like dough. It's kind of malleable, a bit soft, a bit stretchy. So when there's a heart like that, then equanimity is developing as well. And equanimity has this quality of, unshakability, not because it's not feeling. So the near enemy, so-called, of equanimity is indifference. which I think is really important. This is not about, it's exactly what I was saying at the beginning of this talk. It's not about separating ourselves and becoming cold and indifferent to our experience. It's about having a large enough container to be able to receive what is happening without being blown about like this, or if we are blown about, to be able to receive that, come back, center, and hold that. I'm being blown about. So, yeah, I think it's really, really important that to not confuse that with indifference, which it's very easy to do. Again, because we actually have a lot of fear about entering into our experience sometimes and allowing our heart to be affected. And that's not what practice is about. Practice is about actually learning to trust to come into our experience, but in a grounded and aware way, that we don't follow harmful tendencies and create more suffering. So I'm going to end with a poem, which I heard when I was on retreat in June. Went to this amazing wilderness retreat with two teachers, Susie Harrington and Aya Ananda Bodhi. And it was an outdoor retreat. It was really great outdoor retreat. So lots of winds and blowing about and the Pacific Ocean crashing, and it's a great environment. And Susie Harrington read this poem, which relates to the quality of equanimity. So I thought I'd end with that. It's called The Little Duck by somebody called Donald Babcock. Now we are ready to look at something pretty special. It's a duck, riding the ocean 100 feet beyond the surf. No, it's not a seagull. A gull always has some raucous, do you know what raucous is? Raucous, loud, touch about him. This is some sort of duck. And he cuddles into the swells. The swell is like the rise and fall of the ocean. He isn't cold, and he's thinking things over. There's a big heaving in the Atlantic, and he is part of it. He looks a bit like a mandarin, or the Lord Buddha meditating under the bow tree. But he has hardly enough above the eyes to be a philosopher. He has poise, however, which is what philosophers must have. And this is the bit that I really love. He can rest while the Atlantic heaves, because he rests in the Atlantic. Probably he doesn't know how large the ocean is, but he realizes it. And what does he do, I ask you? He sits down in it. He reposes in the immediate, as if it were infinity, which it is. He has made himself a part of the boundless by easing himself into it, just where it touches. I like the duck. He doesn't understand much, but he's got religion. So, yeah. He has made himself a part of the boundless by easing himself into it just where it touches him. So. So thank you for your listening, and I hope there's something useful in there.